That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to another weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. Today, another dipping of our toes into an adjacent tech space that we cover now and then, but don't really know all that much about. Another episode where I learn more and hopefully you learn more. And speaking of spaces, we're talking about space. Space tech, the final frontier of tech. Bill Gattle is the president for Space and Intelligence Systems at Harris Corp. We're going to talk today about the state of the space industry, how soon will space tourism be a thing, and we're going to talk about a revolution in space tech that I knew nothing about, small satellites or small sats. Miniaturization and Moore's Law comes for all of our niches, I guess. My thanks to Bill Gattle of Harris Corp. I believe you've had experience all across the space industry for like a couple decades now or so. Can we start by just setting the stage of the industry? Like from the outside, I guess reading, you know, just headlines and things like that, I feel like there's been this surge of privatization over the last several years. And maybe that's true, more true in the U.S. than in other countries. But generally, is the space industry, has it been going private, or is that just me from the outside not knowing that it's always been sort of mostly private?
So it's the last decade has probably been the most extraordinary decade we've ever seen in both the commercial as well as the government space industry. So the acceleration we've seen is on both sides, and there's a couple reasons for it. It's probably one of the fastest growing industries in the U.S. You saw a lot of budgets coming in right now. So it's got a lot of excitement around it, and you're right. There's a lot of talk in the media about it. Part of it's because space is now an infrastructure that's critical. We absolutely depend upon it every day. And if you think back a decade ago, we probably weren't talking about DirecTV and SiriusXM radio that we needed every day, and it was connectivity. All the weather forecasts come through space. Every time you do Google Earth of your house, you're using a satellite picture of it. All the financial systems across the world are using GPS. And the clocks that are on GPS. So it's become critical infrastructure for the world. And as it has been doing that, people started to realize you could commercialize it as well and move it from a government-only kind of entity to something that actually could benefit a larger portion of the population versus things like internet for everyone. And so about a decade ago, you saw the rise of the entrepreneurs coming into the space market, the people like Elon Musk and Greg Wyler at OneWeb and Blue Origin with Jeff Bezos, and you saw Richard Branson come in on Virgin. They're all bringing in a lot of venture capital money, so we weren't so dependent upon the government, and that has shifted the entire marketplace for space. And so at this point, what you're seeing is just as strong as a commercial market in space as you did government. And you're also seeing a very different dynamic, which is space is not as dependent upon the government anymore. It actually has these other avenues by which they can go off and get capitalization out of the venture capital market. So we are seeing an extraordinary shift, and it has truly transformed the space industry as we know it.
Well, obviously the thing that gets the general interest headlines is the concept of space tourism. And on this show, I have a running sort of joke bet where about self-driving cars, where I always heard we were going to have self-driving cars by 2020. Is that really going to pay off? Well, similarly, I keep, you know, have been told for years that, you know, actual space tourism, like in a regular way, is just around the corner. So do I have another bet here? How far away is on the regular space tourism, you think?
I don't think it's in the next couple years by 2020. I mean, I think that would be great if we could do it. You certainly are getting closer. If you talk about the automated cars, we're getting a lot closer with the GPS signals. You also have a lot of the abilities to steer through towns, but you still have a lot of things that have to happen before we have that be mainstream. In terms of space tourism, it's a lot of the safety of flight, right? I think the wealthy can go up and have a flight these days for $20 million, at least get into space for a couple minutes. But after that, for it to be commonplace, we're probably, in my opinion, 5 to 10 years away, just because of the safety of flight, the proving of the technology that's necessary in order to get into orbit.
Some of the things that we end up talking about on this show, again, to use the analogy of the self-driving car technology, is, you know, who's ahead, who's got the best technology at any given time. So among the maybe the names that I would know, like SpaceX and Blue Origin, Virgin, who's got the best tech? Maybe it's a name that I wouldn't know, but who's ahead in terms of being the go-to, maybe leader, the Waymo, if it were, of private commercialized space tech?
So there's a couple different categories. One is the one you're dealing with, which is launch. So the launch vehicles, SpaceX is by far in the lead. If you think about what Elon Musk did the last few years, he made tremendous investments in trying to get the space vehicle at about half the price that the government was charging for rockets. And he also has the ability to share rides, which means you can have multiple satellites per rocket launch, which is very beneficial, driving the cost way down. So he's probably in the lead in terms of that. He's also had a very progressive view of how to get the government to actually use his rockets. If you recall back, he actually sued the government to tell them they really needed to consider his launch vehicle, and that actually helped his business a lot as well. Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin are doing something different. What they're trying to do is they're trying to create infrastructure in space that will allow exploration of space beyond just our atmosphere. And so what he's doing is a little bit different than what Elon Musk is doing. Jeff Bezos, if you read some of his articles, what he keeps talking about is the reason why he was successful with Amazon is because infrastructure existed. He didn't have to figure out how to do delivery to door service. He didn't have to figure out how to do shipping. All that existed, and it allowed Amazon to ride on top of that infrastructure. So he's a firm believer that that infrastructure in space will take us to a whole new level of exploration and use of space. Some of the other ones are a lot farther back in that particular realm. So you're seeing a lot of smaller companies now come in, including in Silicon Valley, on the payload side, which is the thing that's actually doing the real work in space, taking pictures and such like that. That's an emerging market. And so there's a lot of players there. And there's a lot of talk about how do you get enough capability on those affordable small systems to actually be meaningful. And so that's where that market is. There's really no one clear leader in that market. But in terms of launch vehicles, it's by far SpaceX right now.
What about the idea of internet delivery, internet ISPs from satellites? Where are we on that? Again, another topic that I feel like I've been hearing about for two decades, and it has never quite come to pass.
Well, it's interesting because I think right now OneWeb has probably got a lead on that. What Greg Weiler did and his team, they're trying to really get it direct to remote regions. And I think that he's probably, as he puts up the launches for the OneWeb satellites, which are starting to happen now, he will probably remain in that lead. If you look at this market, though, and how you commercialize to get the services and those kind of service products, typically you have to get the technology right. Then you have to get the regulatory and the policy areas correct so that you can actually downlink and have internet access through these satellites. And then you have the investment of putting out the infrastructure, and then you get the service. So if you look at that 3 or 4 step process, we have pretty much gotten to the regulatory process and investment. What we haven't proven is that we can hit a cost point for people that you'd want to buy the internet, unless you're way out in a remote region and you're willing to pay a little bit extra, just like you do on an airplane. When you're wanting to get Wi-Fi in your airplane, you're going to spend that little extra because you really want to be connected. Those are the kinds of things that are now. It'll take a couple more years before you see the service levels come down to a price point where everybody can get it.
Let's talk about something that actually reading an interview with you in Politico actually turned me on to this. I wasn't even aware of it. Tell me about the small satellite revolution.
Yeah, so this has been interesting. It actually transformed our company. So if you think about Harris Corporation, we were kind of we would be normally called an aerospace and defense company and more traditional. And the small satellite market really made us sit up and take notice. So when we looked at it, we started to think that the market was going to move to a place where affordability was going to be key and speed to space was going to be key. And it was enabled by all the things we just talked about, launch being cheaper. There's no way we could launch a small satellite and pay $70 million for a rocket. That wasn't going to work. But as the launch market transformed, all of a sudden the ride to space became much cheaper. And so we basically, I use it the analogy, the hockey analogy, we skated to where the puck was going to be. And so we transformed our company to to go after these smaller satellites. What's a small satellite? Why would you even want one? Typically on a large, exquisite satellite for the government or even commercially, it's going to take you about a decade to get it on orbit, to design it, and to make sure it works. That's just way too long for what the market wants today. So we basically transformed ourselves to build single-purpose capability into a small satellite. So it's not the Swiss Army knife of satellites, but it can do a single purpose and it can do it very well. And so that began to transform. We actually started with something called hosted payloads, which was somebody else has a satellite, like a condominium, and I rent some space on that satellite to do a mission. And so that's the way we drove the cost down. One of the first things we did was we put a airplane tracker on a communication satellite. And that airplane tracker is called Arion. And recently you saw the result of why that was valuable. And that was with the Boeing jets. What happened was we could actually from space watch the trajectory of the jet as it went up. And we were one of the ones that supplied data to that market to say, look, that was a really strange kind of trajectory it had. Tracking it from space allowed us to do that versus having it be from a radar on the ground. So all of a sudden, we had a very useful capability and a very small package that we could deliver very quickly, and it's begun to transform the market. It can't do everything. It's not the universal Swiss Army knife satellite. But for specific uses like tracking aircraft, it is very powerful and can be done very cheaply. I was building those satellites for under $1 million a copy, which in the market of satellites, that's very cheap.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity, but user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines, their family group chat, their crossword puzzles, just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance. So literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately, no more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. I have personally used ZocDoc to find a podiatrist when I needed one for the first time ever in my life. Go to ZocDoc.com/techmeme and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/techmeme. ZocDoc.com/techmeme.
Well, and this is what I found fascinating. Like, the idea of everything in tech has been about getting smaller and cheaper. And so it's even true. Like, I guess I had no idea, like, how big have satellites been generally, and what are we talking about, like, in terms of the cheaper and the smaller? Like, what is the difference between a small sat and a traditional satellite?
So a traditional exquisite satellite can be as big as a small bus. I mean, they can be very big vehicles or a truck kind of size. And the small satellites that we've been launching are anywhere from a carry-on bag that you would have on an airplane you put up in the overhead bin, or even smaller than that, where they look like a couple shoeboxes size. The question is can they be useful? Anybody can launch something like that, but if all it does is generate heat, as I used to call them, if they're just a toaster in orbit, that doesn't help us. What you have to do is have real missions. And so we've basically been able to figure out how to transform the technology to put very capable electronics and very capable apertures, which are the things that basically pick up the energy, in a very small package. And so it's made them very useful in a very small package, very powerful, small package. If you think back, for example, phones used to be really big, but now your iPhone's small and you have all those features on it. That's what you're doing. You're basically shrinking everything down and putting as much capability as you can in it.
And then the idea, what is the advantage of having these smaller satellites? Again, because they're cheaper, you can launch more. So then you can do these things like create a whole constellation of like hundreds of them all tied together. What does that accomplish?
So there's a balance of these things. If you build one big satellite, it's can cover lots of area and it is very, very capable. But it also can only be refurbished every 10 years or so, 15 years, because of its cost. They're billions of dollars. The small satellites allow you to do is constantly be upgrading technology. So if you think about the computer industry or your phone again, everybody wants to have the most recent revolution of technology. These small sats allow you to upgrade technology very fast and stay current with the market. And so you can be right on the cutting edge of technology at all times because you're relaunching them all the time. And because they're so inexpensive, that's an affordable way to do it. If they were $300 million a copy, you couldn't do it. But given that they're like $1 million a copy, that's not so bad in the space market. And so what you're able to do is quickly replenish, very fast capability to space, and you're getting a lot of capability in a very small package and for a very low price. And so it's all about speed and capability and staying up with the most modern technology.
Harris launched its first small sat just this past December?
Back in the end of November and beginning of December. Yeah, we weren't known as the satellite prime. So if you would have asked probably anybody, any of your listeners about, does Harris launch satellites? They would have said, probably not. I don't know those of them for that. So we internally invested in building our own satellite to prove we could, and we were credible in the marketplace. And so, yeah, we launched our own satellite out of India. We hitched a ride in India with another 60 or so satellites, and we have it on orbit. It's working very well, but it builds credibility in the market that we know how to do this. We can do the end-to-end mission, so to speak. And so, yes, we made that investment.
And right now, are primarily the contracts that you have to do small sats, are they primarily government contracts, military contracts?
They're primarily government and military contracts at this point in time. They are the leaders in that. Now, we do have contracts with slightly bigger things than small sats. You might know it for WorldView or GOI, which is the thing that produces your Google Earth imagery. So we've had those contracts. All those satellites are ours. They're not huge satellites. They're on the smaller side of what we'd call exquisite satellites. But most of the ones we're seeing that are very small, these suitcase size or carry-on size, are through the military and the government.
And so then the idea there is that it's about delivering immediate actionable data from battlefields in as close to real time as possible, that sort of thing?
Yeah, what you're trying to do is trying to get situational awareness, is what they call it in the military. They're trying to get a picture of what's going on in the world. You'll hear the generals in the different Air Force areas say they don't want to blink. They don't want to be staring at something, a missile, a rocket or whatever on the ground, and then blink and lose it for a little while and not know where it is. So a lot of this is about making sure you have persistence over an area, that you're getting that information back to the military or the warfighter as fast as possible, and making sure they have situational awareness. The other piece of it is we have a lot of valuable assets in space right now. So a lot of our world is around defending and protecting those assets as well. But most of what we're doing is trying to give situational awareness.
I read you say that until recently, there had been sort of a general resistance to small sats. Why was that? Was it just a new way of doing things, like disruption, like the classic sort of thing?
It was. There's two big reasons why. The first one is most people viewed them as a toy, that they didn't really have high value. And so the mission value of what they were trying to do was not as great as what they would like. The other part of it, it was a threat to the large satellites. People thought we were trying to replace the big satellites with these small ones. And you really can't do that. It's an augmentation. It's a fill-in. It's a gap filler. It fills in where the big satellites can't perform. But you can't really replace all large satellites with small ones. That's not a really reasonable discussion to have. But they are very valuable in the augmentation area.
Well, Chris Dixon's famous quote is that the next big thing always starts out dismissed as a toy. But so final question. There's a whole universe of this that maybe we're on the cusp of. We're not there yet. But like there's microsatellites and nanosatellites and picosatellites. So like is this, again, the analogy to what, you know, consumer tech is like eventually can we be launching like tiny satellites like as the size of my hand or something like that?
And you can today. It's a matter of packaging what is currently big into those small areas. So, for example, we have one that's probably 12 to 14 inches across and maybe 4 inches wide in that kind of a cube. And we're packaging an antenna that can go out that's over a meter, you know, 3 or 4 feet in diameter out of that little tiny package. So it's about packaging things down in very small volumes and having the electronics be very progressive. But yes, that is coming, and we will proliferate small satellites throughout what's happening in space, and they will have value. We have to wait for the technology to get there. We're probably at, again, the carry-on suitcase size for high value, but it'll get smaller and smaller as technology continues to drive smaller and smaller and higher capability.